Coming up on this edition of the Golf Digest podcast, we chat with 1983 PGA champ and two-time Players champ Hal Sutton, and also get into Patrick Reed's wild week in Mexico.
My God, my swing feels like an unfolding lawn chair.
Well, why do they even have one if you're not supposed to hit it there?
Because it's fun! We're having fun!
What is this, custom? Mine's off the rack.
I wish Tiger Woods was here to help me with this.
We'll do it live!
Welcome back to the Golf Digest podcast. I'm Alex Myers. Today I'm joined by Sam Wyman, Daniel Rappaport. Dan, I got to start with you because you've been out of the mix for a while. Not that you haven't been doing anything. You've been very busy. First off, you caddied for
Matthew Fitzpatrick.
So drew a total blank there. He's only one of the best players in the world. Matthew Fitzpatrick at Pebble Beach. Just what was that like?
Yeah, it was. Awesome first 3 days is how I would describe it. The first 3 days, especially after Saturday. I'm going to go with we, full caddy parlance.
Wow,
we.
I like it.
So we were one shot outside the cut going to the 15th hole on Saturday because it's one round at each of the three courses and the cuts after Saturday. And super nervous. He had just made three birdies in four holes and hits his drive down the middle on 15 and says to me, if we get two more in the
week. He said we?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow.
We were full okay. We all week.
like
he said, if we get two more by the end of the round, we'll be totally fine, meaning, two more birdies. Mm-hmm. And I said to him, screw two, let's get four. And he kind of laughed. And then on 15, he hit an 8-iron to 3 inches.
Woo.
Birdie. 16, eagle. Eagle on 16, made like a 14-footer on 16 for eagle, then birdied 17, and then par 18. So he ended up getting four.
Wow.
Got to 6-under total. And he was like tied 18th, I think, going into Sunday. And I called my girlfriend, I called my parents after Saturday, and it was like manic energy. I was like, this is the best thing in the world. He's so hot. Two eagles on the back nine on Saturday. It's going to be windy tomorrow. Matt's a great wind player. we're gonna be in the top 10. I'm going to make a huge chunk of money, and we're going to be, this caddying stuff is for me. And then, the narrator, 22 hours later, I'm like, get me the heck out of here. Shot 79 on Sunday, and it was brutal. As a caddy, it was tough just because you're trying to say the right things and you're trying to salvage a solid finish and maintain respectability. But then also as a friend, like, you're just watching your buddy just have one of his worst days as a professional.
Right.
I think he's only shot worse than that once or maybe twice in his 6 years as a pro. So it was, I had the full range of emotions, I'll say that much. But it was an incredible experience, one I don't forget and definitely has me wanting to do it, not all the time, but I think, a couple times a year I could definitely, because it's a lot, it's very mentally, and I wrote about this in a piece that I think is coming out soon. I never really knew what these guys meant by mentally tired. I thought that was always just kind of hogwash. They say, being in contention is mentally tired. We weren't even close to contention. And on Sunday on the ride home, I just remember thinking, like, I am completely pooped.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much physically, the bag is heavy, but I'm a young guy. It wasn't that bad. But just being completely invested in something for that long really takes a lot out of you. And it was amazing to me that, Monday morning he played Riviera. He played the secondary pro-am, and, he had no time to sort of decompress. But just like we got back to L.A., and the next week starts right away. For me, I took Monday off to just not really do much because it was very, not so much mentally, physically tiring, but very, very mentally and emotionally draining.
How were the conditions for, we've heard different stories about caddies getting treated poorly, or at certain tournaments they get treated great. And, we've seen caddies talk about that online. What was it like for you in terms of dining and locker rooms or whatever?
Yeah, so I very much kind of tagged along with Matt all week. I think full-time caddies are a bit more established, a bit more comfortable hanging out with other caddies and hanging out in the caddy room and... I was just kind of tailing Matt all week,
were allowed to do that.
Yeah.
Were you allowed to do that because you had a press pass too?
No.
Oh, okay.
The press pass actually got me into some places that the caddy pass wouldn't have.
Because
I went up to them the first day and I was like, because you need to get a credential for the caddy, and I was like, I don't really know what to do because I have this credential. They're like, that gets you in more places than the caddy thing. So I didn't even get a caddy credential.
Right.
But most caddies, they eat in caddy dining and they have their buddies. But Matt got me a player dining.
So
I just went into player dining the whole time. I really just went with him the whole way because I wasn't trying to, if this was my first week on a new job, I think maybe I would have been more proactive about trying to hang out with other caddies and trying to experience the week through the caddy lens, but I was just very much trailing Matt all week. Players were treated unbelievably
right,
well.
Right, that's what I
mean. Unbelievably well. Like, the food was unbelievable. The courtesy cars were great. Even if you didn't have a courtesy car, like, the first day I got there, so I got there on Tuesday, and Matt didn't get there till Tuesday night. So on Tuesday, I'm kind of thinking, like, you know, I need to get back to Carmel because I need to get back to the house. I'm at the golf course. Do I call an Uber? What do I do? And someone was just like, no, just go tell them you need to go to Carmel. Just got a ride into the city, no problem. Wow. Like, it was just everything was to a T. And kind of one moment from the week that really stuck with me was, you hear a lot about these guys being sort of pampered and prissy and very spoiled, the professionals. We were playing a practice round at Spyglass, and we were walking up the 16th fairway, and Patrick Rogers was walking down, this, like, kind of back toward the tee. And Matt said, you know, how we doing, or just some pleasantry. And Patrick Rogers sort of looked around. It was a beautiful day. There was not a cloud in the sky, no wind. It was warm, unseasonably warm as it was all week. Kind of looks around, looks at Matt, and just says, I'm living the dream, bro. And it's true. This is what these guys dreamed of doing. Right. And, you know, the courtesy car to the golf course and the best golf courses in the world and the million-dollar prize funds. And you could see why people are so hesitant or reluctant to give it up. Why pros, when they struggle, or guys who haven't made it. You hear about guys grinding through the minor leagues for 8 or 9 years. And when the top is as sweet as it is, you can understand what keeps these guys going.
Well, I was going to say is that, as pampered as these guys are, there is no insulating them from, like, the pain of a 79.
Yeah.
Like, when you shoot 79, the misery factor is still very much there. However, to your point, Matthew Fitzpatrick is fine.
That's,
you know, he's gonna eat fine that night. He's gonna have a nice place to live. You know, imagine having that experience, you know, two rungs down, where, you know, you're talking about real dollars and cents at stake.
100%, and that's, I think, one of the reasons why he was so all right after he made all those bogeys, because it was like, okay, if Matt misses the cut this week, he's still playing Riviera next week. He's still playing Mexico the week after. And that's why he could afford to be not super stressed, because, like you said, he's financially secure. He knows that he's not really worried about losing his card or anything like that. And I think that's also why on the 18th hole on Sunday, he's six over or something for the week, or six over for the day, and he hits his drive kind of just behind the tree on 18, you know, the tree in the fairway. Mm-hmm. And we're discussing, you know, should he go for it? Should he not go for it? And he says, you know, I kind of want to go for it, but I have to protect my lead.
Mm-hmm.
And so he made a joke in the middle of the 18th fairway when he's six over par. And I didn't expect that joke. And we, you know, we had a really good laugh even in that moment. I think that really speaks to what you were saying, where not every guy can sort of afford to make that joke. And I think on the PGA Tour, most can. You know, if that's the web.com tour, I think there's another layer of darkness that there wouldn't be.
Do you remember, I was thinking about this recently anyway, do you remember last year, and it was because it was in Mexico, when they had those two Mexican boys trailing Rory? They were huge fans of Rory in Mexico, and Rory fell short of winning, and the kids were devastated. Show the video. And then Rory could pass him back, and it's okay, it's still a good week.
Yeah.
And that was, like, to me, in a nutshell, it's a little bit of Rory, like, such a great, you know, broader view of the world and life, but also the PGA Tour, which is still a pretty good week.
Yeah, still pretty good week. You know? Right.
Yeah, and that's sort of, we talked about that on the car ride home. It was just sort of like, there's the nature of professional golf and the nature of the PGA Tour is you really can't let those rounds affect your confidence. Otherwise, you're going to be, because he was playing the next 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
If he really sits there and stews on the 79 and you know, talks to his coaches for hours, how could this happen, blah, blah, blah. You know, you have to sort of externalize everything and just say, that was a bad day, there was weird stuff going on, this isn't me, and then, you know, you get back to it the next week, because you simply can't let that sort of thing affect your confidence, or it's already ruined 1 week. If you let it affect your confidence, it's going to ruin the next week and the week after that.
Right.
So it was really an interesting insight into how a professional, and, you know, one of the top 25 players in the world kind of, their psychology about one tournament and multiple tournaments. So a really fascinating week that I definitely won't soon forget.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, it's a great side gig as well.
Yeah.
Could have been a little more lucrative. We all were thinking that you were going to have a big payday, but whatever. You had a nice week. I did want to know if how the caddy foods, you know, measured up to the media food. But
I did go in there on Tuesday, and the caddy food was there was sort of one main course option,
okay,
and maybe a couple cookies. I would say the caddy food probably from the same ilk as the media dining. Yeah,
I bet it's the same.
Player dining was definitely a step above.
Yes, okay.
It was and that week, I think, especially because of all the celebrities that were there.
Mm.
Like, there were more more Hall of Fame quarterbacks than golfers in the field, 100%.
Right.
You had Matt Ryan, Peyton Manning, Aaron Rodgers, Eli Manning, Tony Romo, who's probably not in the Hall of Fame as a player, but obviously super. So I think they were definitely putting on a little bit for the celebrities.
Gotcha.
But very, very impressed with the player dining and the brownies for sure. And the smoothie bar and the coffee bar and, you know.
Nice. It's quite the life. All right, let's get to Patrick Reed because obviously he wins in Mexico, but there's a bigger story here in that everybody is still talking about what happened in the Bahamas at Tiger's tournament. And in fact, earlier in the week, you had maybe the best player in the world and one of the biggest voices in golf both speak out about this. Brooks Koepka flat out said, yes, I think Patrick Reed cheated. Peter Kostas then goes on the No Laying Up podcast, and he says, I've seen him improve his lie up close and personal 4 times. So Patrick Reed had to deal with all this, but yet nothing bothers him, Sam. Or at least he makes it like nothing bothers him, and he's able to come back and win on Sunday in Mexico for another big tournament.
I mean, I saw your tweet, which is like, put aside everything else that's going on around this guy. What a career he's having.
Incredible resume.
And a resume he's building, and certainly not even close to being done.
Right.
And, you know, there's two types of people, right? There's people who this type of all this background noise would drain them and maybe sap them of energy. And there's guys who somehow gain energy from it or gain motivation from all this, animosity that's directed toward him. And he's certainly the latter. And we'll see how long it takes. The one thing I will say is I think, you know, it's a mistake from a optics standpoint, from a public relations standpoint, to not address this head on at some point. And his argument most certainly would be, I don't care. I don't care about my PR.
Exactly.
You know, who are
still
you?
Still pay him.
Right. They still pay him. But I would say is that this will never go away. And that's the thing.
It's not.
Is it will never go away, especially when we're talking about breaking the rules in golf, because it's the most unforgivable thing you can do in golf. And to not address it. I mean, look at all the guys, I don't want to go through it, the guys who've had this hanging around their neck for as long as they have. And all those guys have you know, failed to address it head on, and it stuck with them. And it will stick with them for as long as he has. So, and that will always be a line that fans and media, for the most part, will never cross in saying, you know what, Good for Patrick Reed. You know, what a great story. I'm so happy for him. That's always going to be something that's going to hold people back because he refuses to own this or address it, really.
Yeah, and it's funny. I mean, he was dressed in all black, and there's a movie, Once Upon a Time in Mexico, and Johnny Depp was wearing all black, and he's this villain. And it just reminded me of that. I mean, it's almost like he embraces it, Dan. You know,
I think he definitely does.
Right? I mean,
well, I think if you watch a press conference from yesterday, and someone asked him a question, you know, do you feed off this? And if you just read the transcript, he says, you know, I don't really worry about it. You know, I'm here to win a golf tournament. But look at his face after they ask him the question. He kind of takes a second and he's smiling.
Yeah.
He clearly does feed off it, whether he wants to admit it or not.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think one of the unique things about golf is, you know, he doesn't have to deal, apart from once every year when he's on the Ryder Cup team or the President's Cup team, he doesn't have to deal with teammates. And, you know, how much they pay you for winning doesn't change based on whether you're a liked guy or not liked guy. Sure, maybe this is hurting his endorsements a little bit, but kind of what you said, Sam, earlier, in golf, I mean, if you're liked or if you're not liked, to a certain extent, it doesn't really matter. You know, your teammates don't have to like you. You don't have to worry about contract negotiations based on your marketability. I mean, you do a little bit in endorsements, but, you know, he made $1.7 million or whatever it was yesterday, no matter whether everyone was rooting for him or, you know, if Reed won, he was winning the same amount if Rory won. And, you know, everyone loves Rory and everybody you know, kind of hates Reed right now. But I think it's important to read between the lines and not just take him at his word when he says, I'm not worried about it, or it doesn't really, you know, he doesn't think about it, because of course he thinks about it, and of course he draws motivation from it. Just look at his face when they ask him these questions.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I admire, and I know it's not, it's sort of a faux pas to say you admire anything about Patrick Reed right now, but you have to admire just his sheer competitiveness, because what drives someone like that is just a competitive fire that, like Sam said, very few people are able to take positives out of the entire community in which you work, in which you live, being against you.
Yeah, I also say, to talk about someone to admire, I admire anyone who doesn't care to that extent, who can separate themselves from perception about them, because I think all of us are, to some extent, shaped by what's being said, you know, about them at some point. So yeah. for him to be like, I don't care. Now, again, I would argue that he does care, and we have evidence to suggest that he does care, but he's putting up a pretty strong facade to suggest otherwise.
Well, he or his wife went on a block rampage on Twitter again yesterday. So someone cares about
even when he wins.
Right, trying to well, because there were a lot of people though obviously bringing up their stuff. I'll tell you what I admire. He closes out golf tournaments. It's amazing because we talk about, as great as Rory is, he looks like an average player on Sundays sometimes in these final rounds. He did it again yesterday,
especially early.
Last week at Riviera, especially
someone
early.
Go
exactly.
Look at his first six holes last whatever times he's in contention.
Exactly. And so a PGA Tour Sunday, we know how tough it is because every week, I mean, I'm sorry, it looks like a gag fest out there. And Reed is one of the only guys who doesn't seem to back up in that situation. Even Justin Thomas, I know he has great stats coming into yesterday. I think he was 8 of 11 closing out 54-hole leads, which is remarkable. He was terrible yesterday. I mean, he was the only person on the leaderboard, basically, that shot, or in the top 10 that shot over par. And so it just shows you all these guys, you know, get bothered by the pressure, the final round pressure. But Patrick Reed, when he has a chance to win, he wins. And again, we talk about his resume. I mean, 8 tour wins, the Masters, obviously, 2 World Golf Championships, 2 FedEx Cup playoff events. He's been a Ryder Cup hero. He's not even 30 yet. So
he's on a Hall of Fame pace.
Sure. I was just going to say, I mean, there's some people who are in the Hall of Fame just because they were good in the Ryder Cup. He's got a lot more going for him. And he's not even 30 yet. And, I mean, yeah, he's going to rack up wins. I mean, you have to think on this pace, he's going to get to 20 wins. He's going to have a DJ career, but maybe with more
feels
big
like
titles.
A guy, he feels like he's got a couple more majors.
Yeah.
Who's a comparable athlete who thrived on sort of negative energy, embraced being the villain? I know everyone keeps talking about the black hat and embraced being a villain, but I'm trying to think of anyone who falls in this category. And I feel like anyone who I might jump to mind, at some point in their career, they came around, or the public came around towards them. I mean, even when we're talking about Kobe. Kobe is...
Right after the trial.
Yeah. And he kind of said, like, I'm going to have my competitive persona, and that's where I kind of have all that's where I channel all my negative energy. Right. But then I have a different persona in person. And I'm just trying to think of, like, it just doesn't seem sustainable for an entire career to have that, be so isolated to the extent that he is.
Because you'd have to think it wears on you a little. I mean, it's just like an extra layer of something to... But in a way, he's become... He's pretty... We all know how isolated he is.
I was going to say, I think
there.
He's very insulated.
Right.
If you listen to also his press conference yesterday, he basically said, I don't read anything. Yeah. I get everything through my team. So his team controls the message to a certain extent. Yes, he obviously hears things when people say things at tournaments. But also, you go to these tournaments and they don't really get heckled.
It's not like an NHL game.
Doesn't compare like anything to other sports. So I think he really does, to a certain extent, he doesn't read all the things that we read, and he knows that there's a general sense of, people don't feel very positively about him. But there's a difference between knowing that in sort of an abstract sense and reading every single tweet and reading every single article and being acutely aware of every, the nuance of what everyone is saying. He knows that there's stuff against him. But if you're not actually reading the words, it's sort of easier to say, yeah, there are people against me right now, but it doesn't really bother me. Then, oh, here's this article and this article and this article.
The one thing I didn't like, though, is, and there was the video, I didn't see the video of the actual interview, but there's this video of him going up to Sky Sports, right, guy and saying, oh, you had to ask that question, didn't you? And kind of like taunting him. When obviously, and the people who saw it said the guy asked a perfectly legitimate question. So he does bristle at some of these questions.
That's kind of evidence that he cares, I mean, to a certain extent, right?
Right.
Yeah. There's no question that he has.
But to your point, I wish he would just, give us a good answer at least one time.
We could get into a really existential conversation about, what does it all matter? I mean, you can win a lot of tournaments and win a lot of money, but at some point, it's a lonely life when there's a lot of sort of negative energy swirling around you. And at some point you're going to stop playing great golf.
Right.
And, it just feels like he would be better served having some level of, I don't know if contrition, he might be like really adamant that he's done nothing wrong.
Right.
But having some level of transparency about what's going on would be allow people in a little bit.
What's funny, too, is he's battling, obviously, down the stretch against Bryson DeChambeau, and totally different scenario here. And by the way, Bryson went up, he's talking about his teammates, Ryder Cup, President Cup teammates, he went up to Reed after, gave him a hug, sort of acknowledged that they're kind of in the same boat and that they have a lot of people rooting against them. Again, Bryson, it's for much different reasons. But what did you make of his week? And, you know, he had the towel guy there. He's doing a lot of Bryson things. He was hitting bombs, which we've seen. Obviously, he's the bulked up guy. It's helping him off the tee. He can't quite close it out, but it was just a weird situation. There was these two guys, and all of golf Twitter was kind of like, pick your poison, basically.
Yeah, but I think they're sort of different.
Totally
in
different.
In the way that they're unpopular.
Right.
I think Reed is more of a bad actions than bad words guy. Mm-hmm. We were sort of talking about this earlier in the office. You know, I've spent a little bit of time around Reed just at tour events and stuff and kind of spoken to players about him, and he's like a perfectly nice fellow. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think if you played a pro-am round with Patrick Reed, he would be engaging and he would be kind and he would ask you questions, which is not always the case, right, on the PGA Tour. But I think his actions speak for themselves. But I think if you had a conversation with him and you spent time with him, you wouldn't notice anything was off. Whereas Bryson, I think, is a little bit different in that he'll be the first to tell you he's sort of an oddball. Mm. And he will say things, and he has said things. I think back to the Northern Trust last year when he got pretty combative in defending himself about the slow play stuff.
Right.
He will say things and he will, do things on the broadcast. And, there was the video of him aggressively, patting down the green this week, which is amazing because you're obviously allowed to fix bumps before.
Right.
The putt.
And other pros were mocking
and
him, including Lee Westwood.
And other pros were mocking him. Yeah. And I think if you, and I'm going to go as far as saying, I know that if you were to do a survey of PGA Tour players and ask them their thoughts on Bryson and their thoughts on Patrick Reed, if you are able to separate the quote unquote cheating aside, mm-hmm, I think people would say they'd rather have a beer with Reed than DeChambeau. And whether that comes off to the public is a totally different understanding. But I think it is worth it's worth acknowledging that I think Reed is probably a little bit less gruff, just in terms of interpersonal relationships, than Bryson can be sometimes. Bryson's right. A more emotional guy. Bryson's a more sort of frenetic energy guy.
Right.
You watch Reed on the broadcast yesterday, and if you don't know anything, you're just thinking he's a cool customer.
Yeah.
He's a good, mm-hmm, player who knows how to close out golf tournaments. So they're completely different, but yes,
yeah,
those would probably be public enemy number one and public enemy number two in golf. Just on golf Twitter, whether that's representative of the public or not, and those are the guys who are first and second.
Yeah, I mean, I think Bryson's is a lot of it is sensitivity. Mm-hmm. I think it's immaturity to some extent. I think, I think the difference between Patrick Reed and Bryson DeChambeau is that Patrick Reed professes to not care, and I think Bryson does care, and he cares a ton. He cares a ton, and sometimes that surfaces in kind of awkward scenarios. So, I see Bryson to some extent growing out of that over time, and sort of. But there, like you said, there's a lot of frenetic energy around him, and it's hard for people to kind of make sense of him from one day to the next. But I think a lot of that is just kind of a guy who's still, he's spoken to not feeling great about himself and things like that, which play a role as well.
Yeah. I think it's interesting, though, that they're only like 3 years apart, 3 or 4 years apart.
But,
right?
but Reed is like an old.
Reed's been out there for a long time. Right. He's an old soul. Bryson's not an old soul.
Yeah. Right.
It's fair.
Well, a guy whose win was very popular, Victor Hovland, he was the favorite going into the Puerto Rico Open. He gets the job done. He takes a lead. He kind of choked it away with a hideous triple bogey, which he afterwards said, "I suck at chipping," which I think everybody enjoyed that. Dan, I know you were just tweeting about his prospects of making the Ryder Cup team for Europe. This is a guy who looks like a can't miss prospect. I mean,
I think most of the guys who are in the Ryder Cup picture now think he's going to be on the team.
Yeah.
Even the guys who are, talking with Matt and obviously a couple of his, I think there's a general consensus that he's very much so in the running for the team, probably over 50% to make the team if he continues to play the way he does. I think what's most exciting about him is there's still so much room for improvement. And he'll tell you that himself. You watch his interview, and he said the first thing is, my short game needs to get
I suck at
up.
Chipping.
Yeah. I suck at chipping. Yeah. He doesn't suck at chipping, but his chipping does need work, and he has the potential to be a top 10 player within a year.
Wow.
I mean, I really think so. The way you watch him, I think one of my favorite stats about him is when he was an amateur at Pebble Beach at the Indian U.S. Open, obviously, you know, broke Jack's record or something, mm-hmm. he led the tournament in strokes gained off the tee as an amateur.
Yes.
And that shows you how well he drives the ball. He drives the ball as, you know, he's in the Dustin, Rory.
Yep.
He's in that tier off the tee, which is such a huge advantage on today's PGA Tour. And, you know, people always, one of the golf broadcasters' favorite cliches is, you know, talking about Dustin Johnson's wedge game and how when he dialed in his wedge game, it took him to another level. Victor Hovland can do that as well. He's still there's still room for him to really improve. He's I think of those three players, Wolf, Morikawa, and Hovland.
Yeah.
I go back and forth between Morikawa and Hovland as to who's going to have
interesting
a better career.
Yeah.
But I think the fact that all three of them have already won really says something about who they are.
It's amazing they've all won already because there's so much hype around them. They come out, and the fact that all three of them have already gotten it done. I mean, you would think that at least one or two of them, it would take a while. We'd be like, oh, whatever happened to this guy, you know.
Right.
I mean, it's incredible.
And you're right. Like, golf is such a game where, he's the favorite to win in Puerto Rico, which means
it's nothing.
Yeah. Almost nothing. Right? And he goes ahead and wins.
He went and got it done.
I think I admire and kind of relates to what we're talking about with Patrick Reed and Bryson with great self-awareness. He already seems like a guy who
the anti-Reed in that
sense. In that sense. Like, you know, he had great personality, understands weaknesses in his game, what he needs to do, and still delivers. And obviously still has a tremendous amount of confidence in his game as well. So interesting to see next steps for him because, the question was asked, like, are you more relieved or excited? Why would a guy need to be relieved at this point?
He's 22 years old.
Right.
Only because maybe those other two guys already won and he's going to always be compared against those guys. But you're right. I mean, he had plenty of time. The only thing he has to worry about now is the curse of Cocoa Beach, though, because no Puerto Rico Open winner has ever won another tournament ever again. The only time they've ever won anything was Michael Bradley won the Puerto Rico Open again a few years ago. So Tony Finau is the most famous of this. He won.
He's on the cover of the curse.
4 years ago. He has still not won. So good luck to Victor Hovland getting over that. But other than that, the future looks bright. I want to touch on, before we get to our interview with Hal Sutton, the Premier Golf League. Some more details finally came out. We've been hearing whispers. We've been hearing players comment, players getting asked about it, players saying they don't read emails, this and that. Sam, what were your thoughts? I mean, I guess some of the things here, the key takeaways here from Andrew Gardner, who is the CEO of the league. 18-event schedule, 54-hole events, shotgun starts, some scores not counting, some team aspect, teams of four. Anything that pops out that you'd like to see the PGA Tour incorporate?
Well, maybe. I mean, you know, like having more team or kind of funky formats on the PGA Tour, I think would be great, but I don't think that's ever going to happen anytime soon. The thing I was struck by most of all in his comments was a little bit of, I guess, naivete that he thinks that this product can exist in concert with the existing tours, because I see no scenario.
No.
Because he's not backing down from the 18 tournament mandate.
Because they need that for TV.
They need that. Yeah. So how does that work?
Right. Good luck getting Tiger to play 18 events in addition to the majors.
Yeah, well, not only that, but, we're not competing with the PGA Tour.
I mean, you're competing with the PGA Tour.
So to say that is
you're going to take the 50 best guys 18 weeks of the year. You're competing with them. And speaking of one of those guys, though, Dan, I mean, Rory obviously is the guy who's come out now and shot this down. He said, I'm out. Then he said, well, if everybody else goes, I'd kind of have to go.
I'm out now.
But what did you make of his and also, I want to be on the right side of history.
Yes.
That was kind of the soundbite.
Yeah, so I think it's not just that he said no. It's that he sort of laid out his reasons for saying no. He said, I don't want to be controlled by them. And he didn't really say anything about Saudi money. But when he said, I want to be on the right side of history, if you read between the lines, he's making a comment on who the people controlling you would be. So now anybody who says yes to this is going to have to contend with that reasoning.
They're
going to say, what about, Rory said he doesn't want me control, and then they're going to have to find a really fancy way to say that it's not just about the money, because it is clear at this point that if you are going to this new league, it's 90% about the money.
And
I think
it's about the money and their schedule. I mean, that would be the one thing. That would be the one.
But they lose control.
That's what I'm saying. Like, Rory already makes his own schedule. He's in a great position to do that. And now you do lose a little of that.
You lose a lot of it.
But what I'm saying is that they might make the argument that if you get all the best players, they're all playing at the same time every, you know, all the 18 events, that, you know, this schedule is, quote-unquote, could be a stronger product week to week on that tour.
Yeah, overall.
But I don't agree with that. Yeah, no, I'm saying that's what the argument could be.
I just think there was sort of this mystery around it, and then when the details came out, it just was like, oh, this is basically a college golf format.
That's what a lot of people were saying.
It seemed a bit, you know, we have one world champion, or we're going to have a team championship, and the captains are going to, just kind of feels like an all-star game. You know, and I think Nick Faldo tweeted something like, you know, how can you shotgun start and only 48 players, and how can you play on this tour and compare yourself to the greats in history who play at all these events and stuff? And whether these guys care about that is, you know, we can't really speak to that, whether they care about their standing in history, but it just sort of, it just seemed a bit, to use one of my, you know, parents, it seemed kind of fakakta. the whole format just seems
At what point can a shotgun start be anything but decidedly unglamorous? Like, there's no, every time you go to a tournament, like, oh, it's a shotgun start, like,
Rory, you're 6B today.
6B, yeah, right.
Take
your cards out to the hole.
Yeah. I mean, look, in theory, it's smart. You kind of, you get everything more compact. And for the broadcast, everybody can see everything.
It's like, but I just, you know, with the dream of winning this tournament, coming up that fifth fairway.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they can't do it. They can't do it on Sunday. But
no, I think it's only the first two rounds, or maybe the first one.
Yeah, I don't know. Sure. And to me, the whole juggling of, like, who's in, who's out, obviously, you know, there's going to be fluidity with these 48 players. I guess maybe not each, I guess each year it's going to be set in stone. But then what happens when, you know, Victor Hovland starts winning and then and you have an older star who can't make a cut anymore and they're still getting to play? I mean, I don't know.
I don't mean to shoot holes in.
I think I've come
to the realization that if they do push hard enough on this model, that it will force the PGA Tour to address some deficiencies in their model. So that's a good thing.
And that's what's going to happen.
Yes. I think so for sure.
However, it's just weird. Like, you know, golfer X grows up. Dan Rappaport was a junior golfer, grows up dreaming of winning, you know, a 72-hole tournament, you know, and winning at Riviera and winning. Now you're going to win the team event of a shotgun start. It's just like it's a different model. It's like every other rival league that's been out there has been basically a subtle variation of the existing model,
right?
The ABA, the AFL. But this is totally different.
But what's also different though about it is the four majors are still out there. So technically, the things that most fans identify with will still be there. And so you could do this.
I need there to be
unlike the ABA, where you're not going to then play in the NBA Finals. You can still play in the big
tournament. I need the PGL to exist, and I need a non-PGL person to win all four majors.
Right. That would be amazing.
But imagine that dynamic, which is you're playing this weird shotgun start format 18 weeks a year, and then the 4 weeks, okay, this week we're going to play this new thing. It's called stroke play. You're going to go off the first tee.
If you're playing well, you're going to have to wait to tee off until later in the day.
But you're right. Like, a non-PGL guy would be a real scrappy underdog.
Oh, yeah.
Winning a major.
Take this, PGL.
Yeah, exactly. You know, Ryan Moore sneaks out a major and in your face, PGL. All right, obviously one guy who didn't have to deal with the question of the PGL, Hal Sutton, a 1983 PGA champion, a two-time players champion, including that memorable duel with Tiger Woods, and, of course, that memorable saying on the 18th hole. Hit it.
Be the right club. Be the right club today. Yes!
Be the right club today. Just incredible stuff, Hal Sutton. Iconic, really. Anyway, we had a great chat with Hal. Please have a listen to our talk with Hal Sutton.
It's 2020, and we're all looking for ways to improve our health and hit our own personal goals this year, whether it's being smarter about how we train, making a better effort to get more sleep, or simply thinking more about our body's overall wellness. Today's sponsor, Whoop, is a fitness tracker that goes beyond counting steps and provides 24/7 fitness, sleep, and recovery insights personalized to you. There's nothing else like it on the market. Our lives cause different levels of stress on our body, from training to work and our lives at home. Whoop understands that and quantifies it for you into actionable metrics.
With Whoop, you'll get daily recovery score that looks at biometrics like heart rate variability, resting heart rate, and your sleep performance to let you know how ready your body is to perform. You're also given insights into the intensity of your training in real time and track how strenuous your day is, as well as get next-level sleep insight with suggested sleep times based on how strenuous your day is, track your sleep stages and cycles, and see how much sleep you get compared to how much you needed. Whether you're looking to be smarter about your fitness, better about your sleep, or be more mindful of your body's recovery, Whoop has you covered. If you're looking to be smarter about how you train, sleep, or recover, Whoop is offering our audience 15% off with the code GD15. Go to whoop.com, that's whoop.com, and use the code GD15 at checkout and optimize your performance with Whoop.
Okay, joining us from Texas is 1983 PGA champion and two-time players champion, Hal Sutton. Hal, thanks so much for joining us.
Glad to do it.
So let's start in with what you're doing now. I know there was a period where you were not playing, mostly due to injury, and then you did some teaching, and now it sounds like you're looking to do some more playing. Where are you right now with your game?
Well, just working on it. You know, I've got three artificial joints now. I've got two hips and a left knee, and you know, I really don't know what I can do with my game with three artificial joints, but I'm anxious to see. I spend a little time working on it every day. Can't practice like I used to be able to at 61, but I still enjoy trying to rev up the engine a little bit.
Yeah. You had mentioned to our Kevin Robbins last year that one of the things that sort of stuck in your craw was that you didn't feel like you had quit the game correctly, that there was a little bit of, a lack of closure to your career. How much of that is still part of the motivation of just kind of exiting on your own terms?
Well, that was a lot of the reason why I wanted to do this. You know, I had no idea. You know, I felt like I was strong and able to play forever, and I mean, I didn't have any idea I was going to have all the joint problems that I've had. And you know, I've spent the last 10 years, I've had five major surgeries in the last 10 years, and you know, I've limped my way through life basically. And you know, now I'm pain free with no limp or anything else, and I guess probably on one hand, I ought to be proud of the fact that I have that and can live a normal life the rest of my life, much less trying to, you know, rev up the engine of a golf game and play at a high level. Maybe that should be a real secondary goal.
Hal, how much golf do you watch these days? Have since you've stopped playing as much, have you watched a lot of golf? And what's kind of a typical weekend for you? Are you spending a few hours watching, or are you just kind of catching up on it after the fact?
Well, this last weekend, for instance, I watched quite a bit because it was on a place that was near and dear to my heart. Mm. You know, Riviera, there's very few places in the world like Riviera. So, you know, I enjoy watching the golf at Riviera. I don't watch as, you know, I watch TPC because that's a special place and a special championship. I watch Augusta. I watch the majors. But, you know, the game has changed so dramatically. You know, the game was more fun when we were trying to figure out how to keep the ball from curving so much instead of bombs away and the ball, just worry about your start line because it's not going to curve very much. Mm. And, you know, I think it's actually hurt the game. A lot of this has really, really hurt the game. And people weren't paying attention. They got caught up with the sexiness of how far a ball would go. And you know, the real sexiness of this game is control over the ball. Mm. And, you know, I'll tell you something. That's one of the things that people that can actually afford the game are the people that were trying to control the curvature of the ball. You know, they wanted to stop that slice because if they could straighten that slice out, the ball would go a little bit further. And the metal wood alone was the biggest change in the game.
Really?
And, yes, sir, they can talk about the ball all they want, but the metal wood changed the game. Trying to hit a wooden club, there was an art to that. And if they wanted to change the game, they could take metal woods out of it and say, okay, we're going back to a wooden club. I guarantee you, it would change the game immediately.
The you know, of course, you mentioned that Riviera is a place near and dear to your heart, where you won the PGA in 1983. And when you watch it this past weekend, and you talk about changes that you're seeing in the way the game is played, I mean, is the lack of, I guess, artistry apparent to you even watching at a course like that? Because people always talk about how you know, Riviera is one of the few places where you still have to be a real shot maker to succeed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, yes, and it was very evident as they played around there. And the other thing that's very evident is that even though they have all the length that they have, the scores are no lower. Mm-hmm. And it perplexed some of the best players in the game still. And, of course, they've lengthened Riviera. They've made it quite a bit longer and harder. But, you know, like number 12 is outrageously long there now. And, you know, they took 8 out and made it long. And, you know, used to, you had to curve the ball at number 8 there. I mean, it was not a long hole, but you could get in a lot of trouble. You know, I made a lot of birdies and some doubles, too, because I didn't curve the tee shot to the right. And got behind the eucalyptus trees and got in trouble. So,
yeah, and to be clear, I mean, obviously, you're talking about, you know, how the game has changed, and this the USGA Distance Insight report came out recently about how distance is now something that's, you know, clearly on their radar. What would your suggestion be? Would it be actually, you know, getting rid of metal woods? Do you think something needs to be done about the ball, or do you think anything needs to be done at all?
I don't know what suggestion there is. I think something has to be done. I don't know what it is. You know, but here's the real crying shame in this. How many billions of dollars later is this coming? Mm. And by the way, who paid the billions of dollars? The person enjoying the game. Mm-hmm. The consumer that got nothing out of it. That's the real struggle in this whole thing. How many golf courses spent $5 million changing their golf course?
Yeah, a lot.
I mean, there was, if we had suddenly no policemen on the street, everybody would be driving 100 miles an hour and killing somebody if they got in their way. And that's actually what happened in the game of golf.
You know, we mentioned TPC Sawgrass. Obviously, you won there. The second edition that the Players' Championship was held there. The first one got so much publicity for the Players kind of, you know, revolting against this new course created by Pete Dye. When you won the second year, had a lot of that quieted down, and obviously it must have fit your eye because you ended up winning there again a bunch of years later.
Well, you know, change is always difficult, and TPC was a major change in 1982 when it came about. And, you know, I think Players, it wasn't a traditional golf course, and it was very difficult. You know, it was much harder in 1983 when I won it than it was in 2000. Similar golf course, but it had been refined and changed and much softer to the eye than the original one was. And but TPC is a great venue. It's a great golf course. The tour's done a great job with that championship. And, you know, I'm proud to say that I was able to finish on top there twice.
Yeah, you're one of the only people who've won there twice. I don't think anybody's won there 3 times, and it seems like it's maybe the most unpredictable of the big venues. We hear different reasons for that. You know, maybe it's not really a bomb and gouge course like so many of these other tracks. Is that why you think it's such an unpredictable and makes for such a great venue?
Well, it's a shot maker's golf course. I mean, it's a point A to point B to point C type of golf course. It's mm-hmm. not how far can you hit it.
Right.
And it's also a mental challenge because you have to control your nerves at that place because mm-hmm. there's a lot going on the back nine. There's birdies, there's eagles, there's doubles, there's triples. There could be even more than that, the way the risk's set up. And so from a fan's perspective, it's exciting. From a player's perspective, it's unnerving. And, you know, the biggest thing that has to happen is you have to remain calm and in control of your nerves and really not pay a lot of attention to what everybody else is doing. I mean, you really have to play to your own game plan.
You won at TPC in 83, and then of course you won again in 2000, and obviously in between, or there was the win in the PGA. And I read somewhere that you said that it's not even close, that of the tournaments you're known for best, it's the 2000 Players, because it came with you and Tiger Woods down the stretch. I'm curious, how often are you reminded of that? And I was going to obviously ask you about the Be the Right Club today in terms of. Were you always a guy that talked to your ball, or was that just a kind of a one-time thing that was caught on camera at the right time?
Well, I say 2000 against Tiger was the my biggest win, and here's the reason why. When I beat Jack, he was 42 years old. So his career, even though he was still a great player at that time, his career was beginning to go on the downward trend. And at the time that I beat Tiger in 2000, his career was on the uptrend. And it was easy for everybody to see that he was going to be a very dominant player. And, at the time, he had turned back everybody on Sunday because they didn't, I guess, they succumbed to the world didn't think anybody could beat him. They spent all night Saturday night trying to tell me how foolish I was for thinking that I could beat him. It got so frustrating. It was unbelievable. And, so that's why it was my biggest win. And then as far as Be the Right Club today, I wasn't really known for talking to my ball, but the importance of that and knowing how I was only one shot ahead and I'd hit it right at the flag, but how we're splitting hairs out there, and just a puff of wind could have changed the whole outcome of that. Mm-hmm. And, if something got behind that ball and it went over the green, I'd have had an incredibly hard up and down from there. And, it just came to my mind. Just don't surprise me. Be what I see you being,
I guess that does beg the question. I'm sure you've answered this before, which is, were you contemplating a different club at any point before hitting that? Was it a 5 or a 7?
No, I wasn't. It was a perfect 6-iron for me. And, but I can't tell you how many times in the course of my career that I had the perfect club and some outcome changed it. And, even when I hit a shot right at the flag, and to watch it fly over the green or whatever else for whatever reason, I think that's what we love about golf is you can never totally control it. Mm-hmm. And in that situation, they just showed it 2 nights ago and I watched it because my wife wanted to, and I didn't miss many shots that day. I missed one fairway and one green, and I hit the ball right where I was looking almost every time. And, but that still doesn't alter the fact that it could have been different on the last hole. Mm-hmm. And, it's why we love the game. It's why we love the game. We never can control it.
Yeah. You obviously didn't miss many shots. You beat Tiger in 2000. Not many people can say they beat Tiger in 2000. The Be the Right Club today, I think we all say it
right
from time to time. We love it. It's one of the iconic sayings. Going back to that pairing with Tiger, obviously, like you said, you knew already he was going to be a dominant player. He had the two majors under his belt, including the huge win at the Masters in 97. What was it like playing with him? Was there any sort of back and forth between you guys? Obviously, it seems like he usually stays pretty focused during a situation like that.
I don't recall a lot of conversation.
Right.
A little bit of small talk here and there. But we didn't have a lot of conversation. It was friendly.
Mm-hmm.
But we both had a job to do, and we were both taking each step that we needed to try to get to the end with the result that we wanted. And, it was a great day. It stands out in my memory because unlike the PGA, Jack was playing two groups in front of me, so I wasn't watching what he was doing. And in this particular case, I'm seeing everything that Tiger was doing. And it basically, we both had a I don't remember exactly what it was, but, a larger lead over everybody else. Like, right. Maybe five under was second, and we were 10 and 9. So, I mean, third. And so it was kind of he and I. That's who it was. It was right. against, he against myself. And perfect situation. Every golfer hopes they can be in that.
Hal, it's obviously a Ryder Cup year, and it's another landmark moment in your career. Was captaining the 2004 team. That was, obviously didn't go the way you wanted. I'm curious, you've talked a lot about this before, but if Steve Stricker reached out to you for advice, or if he has, what would you tell him about being a captain, and what are some takeaways from that experience for you?
I would suggest make it as fun as he can make it for everybody, and so that they enjoy the week and they're happy that they're there. Most of the Ryder Cups, I played on four Ryder Cup teams and captained that one. And one of the things that I think are a problem for American golfers are tired at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And every one of those guys that are on that Ryder Cup team, their pockets are full too. Mm-hmm. And, they don't have the same energy level to win that they would have earlier in the year. So as a captain, you're trying to do everything you can to keep their energy up to where they want to win. Very few people have ever won when they didn't want to win. You got to want to win. And I'm sure you were probably sitting over there thinking, do you actually have to tell yourself you want to win?
Mm-hmm.
These people play in so many tournaments that, yes, you got to gear yourself up for wanting to win. Do I want to participate this week, or do I want to win this week?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's
there is a distinctive difference.
Yeah, and that's always been kind of one of the conventional sayings about the Ryder Cup, is that the Europeans, are, for a while, cared about it more. Winning actually mattered to them more. Is that something that you sensed even that week?
I put it differently. I think the American players are just tired. You know, their focus is not as strong as maybe the Europeans come in there with. And, I don't know. I'll be 62 in April this year. Maybe I'm removed too far to know how they feel. I'm not sure I know much about the game that Brooks Koepka is playing today, and or anybody else, Justin Thomas or any of those guys. That's not a game that Hal Sutton ever played. So I'm not sure I know anything about it. And,
obviously. But, sorry, Al.
No, I was just going to say, I've always had an opinion, and as I get older, I'm finding out that maybe I don't have an opinion. Maybe I don't know.
Obviously, everyone remembers the Tiger Phil pairing that week, and you've talked about it a bunch. But I just, as a captain, that when something doesn't work out, you're going to take the heat, whether that's fair or not. But I just wonder, how surprised were you that Phil, over a decade later, kind of brought this up again in 2016, and I guess maybe surprised, disappointed. What was kind of your reaction to that?
I don't know. I was ahead of my time. They paid him $10 million to be friends and be buddies. I saw it before anybody else. I felt like the game would be better off if they became friends, and they're the two best players out there. But the problem is everybody, their own boat is more important to them than the overall ocean. How naive of me to think that something that I might do that might benefit the game. Maybe I should have been selfish like everybody else in the world. And just done what I thought was important and not cared about anybody else. I was hoping that had they played well together and won a couple of matches, a friendship would have been started that would have forged ahead. And You know, it was a mistake on my part. I look back at it. That's why I quit the game for 5 years. I left and never did play again for 5 years. It personally hurt me a lot because when I didn't play, my hips locked up. And so when I started back trying to play, you know, I ended up eventually having them replaced. And, you know, I was really disappointed after the Ryder Cup in 2004. And I felt like I tried to do the right things and help not only America, but golf. Mm-hmm. And nobody appreciates that. Nobody cares. And shame on me for thinking that somebody might care about that. And so it personally hurt a lot.
Is that to say that you were kind of so gutted by that experience that you kind of took away your motivation to compete?
Totally. I could have cared less about competing at that point. I mean, literally in 5 years, I didn't play 20 rounds of golf.
Wow.
I never carried my clubs in the car. I didn't do anything golf-wise. And honestly, I didn't miss it. So, you know, after that, I started trying to play a little bit. And you know, I did miss the game. I still love the game. I still know a lot about the game. And you know, I wish people cared more about the ocean instead of their own boat. If everything we all did started trying to push the game instead of our own agendas, we'd be in a different boat. Mm-hmm.
Well, obviously, if it had worked out, you would have been hailed as a genius too. So it's you know, we all know that the captain probably takes a little too much blame when stuff goes wrong. I want to ask you, if you were a captain, because obviously Tiger Woods was in this position at the President's Cup, and he had a very unusual situation with the Patrick Reed thing happening the week before, and then having to kind of deal with him being on the team, and not only that, but he was one of his captain's picks. What would you would have done as a captain, I guess, if you had a player like that who was coming off such a controversial thing?
I don't know. I don't know what I would have done. I'll tell you this. If I ever got to ask the captain again, I'd say let them go on their own, because then maybe the blame will fall on the right people.
Yeah.
Because I've yet to see a captain hit a golf shot, period. Right. And I can tell you this. I have never seen a player playing great lose over the course of 5 days. I've seen players that are not playing very good lose constantly. Mm-hmm. And you can't blame somebody else besides the player. Right. I mean, now, we do a good job in America of blaming the captain and everybody else for this. But the truth of the matter is, you know, tell it like it is. Mm-hmm. Tell it like it is.
Right.
And, I mean, we don't seem to do that. We seem to protect for the most part. And, you know, anyway.
Yeah.
Every time I played poorly, I didn't blame it on one of the guys that was a captain during my he didn't toss me. I played first time up for Trevino, the second time I played for Nicholas, the third time I played for Crenshaw, and the fourth time I played for Curtis Strange. Not a single captain tossed me a shot. I didn't drive it in the rough because of one of them. I didn't miss a green because of one of them. I didn't miss a putt because of one of them. I didn't make a putt because of one of them, and I didn't drive it in the fairway because of one of them. You understand my point?
Of course, sure. Yeah.
I mean, and we're not really to that anymore. Right. In the game, we're looking for every other reason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. How you had mentioned that, you know, you kind of don't recognize the game that you played, and a lot of players today use the we. I'm talking about their team when they're talking about the performance. I'm curious, like, what was your quote unquote team in the prime of your career? And I have to imagine it was quite smaller than a lot of these teams are now.
Oh my gosh, me and my caddy. And a guy that worked with me on my golf swing. That's it. I mean, you know, there was no team in those days, really. I mean, I spent more time with my caddy than I did anybody else in the world. That was my team. That was the only person that I could count on. The rest of the people you couldn't count on. I mean, the more people that you get into a situation where they play a vital role, the more they can either let you down or lift you up. And, you know, I don't even know anything about the game they're playing today. I really don't. So, I mean, I should keep my mouth shut and not really voice an opinion. I wouldn't even know where to start. If I had a son, here's what I would tell him. If my son, I do have a son, but if my son was playing golf and he said, Dad, what should I do? I'd say, okay, here's what I'd tell you to do. Work your rear end off to be the best you can be. Don't sign a contract for longer than a year because you can't guarantee that anybody's chasing number one manufacturer-wise harder than you are. But yet, you're probably going to want to sign a contract longer than that because you're going to want job security or financial security. And then the minute you do that is the minute you quit working as hard.
Right.
And that's just the vicious cycle that is out there. And, you know, I mean, you watch it, it shows up all the time out there. I mean, there's very few people that come along like Tiger Woods, regardless of how much money he's got or how much he's playing for. That man still wants to win. You got to admire that.
Right. I just want to ask, how you talked about playing for Crenshaw. We've talked about motivation at Ryder Cups. Obviously, that 99 one is special, and you were part of that huge comeback. You know, you went out there, I think, in the second match. You guys won the first six matches that day. What do you remember about that day, and maybe where were you? Oh, I assume you were there when Justin Leonard made the putt, and what can you remember about kind of that celebration?
Well, that was, you know, one of the most exciting things that I was ever part of in golf, only because we did something together there rather than individually. And, you know, to me, at this juncture in my life, you know, I made a statement the other day, you know, in order to be really good, you got to chase birdies and you got to be selfish. And I said, as we age in life, you start chasing friendships instead of birdies. And because you realize that time has run out on chasing birdies. And, but the reason why I even told that story is because of the importance of being on a team and doing something together. Nothing's better than that. Accomplishing something with other people. And that was a unique week. You know, we were hailed as one of the best teams and far better than, you know, a lot of people thought we were a lot better than, the Europeans, and yet we found ourselves four down going into this, going down into the singles matches. And we knew we had to win the first six matches, so Ben stacked the deck of everybody that was playing the best and said, let's hope that we can get it back to where we want, and then we'll hope that the guys can pull it through coming in the end. And they did, and Justin had not played well all week. And, I mean, I played with Justin on Saturday afternoon, and he did not play well. I mean, we had the match, but, you know, I was playing really well. And, you know, it was great to see Justin do that because it had been a suffering week for Justin. Mm. And, you know, it was a fitting end because, you know, people had talked about how poorly he had been playing and everything else. And then, boom, he makes that putt. And guess what? The rest is history.
Wow. Amazing.
Speaking of, yep. One more thing, how, you know, I just wonder how much would the, I know you've been a finalist for the World Golf Hall of Fame. How much would that mean to you? Obviously a major champ, two-time players champ, a Ryder Cup captain, a Ryder Cup winner. How much would that mean to you to get that honor?
Well, it would mean a lot. You know, I love the game and I love all the people that I've been associated with in the game you know, I played my whole life to be as good as I could be, and then to be recognized by being in the Hall of Fame would, you know, how do you tell somebody how important that would be? Mm-hmm. You know, it's a fitting end for a career.
Yeah. Well, listen, Hal, great insight. Well, thank you so much for joining us, and really wish you the best of luck in you know, wading back into the competitive waters.
Well, if I do, I do, and if I don't, I don't. It's just, you know, we'll see.
For so many golfers, the game just isn't the same without dipping on the green. Watch closely, and you'll certainly catch your favorite players dipping on the course. With Black Buffalo, you can keep the ritual and ditch the tobacco. Black Buffalo is a tobacco alternative that delivers the same experience as traditional smokeless products, just without the tobacco, leaf, or stem. The same taste, the same texture, the same nicotine buzz. It's only available online at blackbuffalo.com. If you dip, you're 21 or over, and you're not using Black Buffalo, it's time to make the switch. Use promo code GOLF for 25% off your first purchase. Warning, this product contains nicotine. Nicotine is an addictive chemical.
All right, thanks again to Hal Sutton for joining us. And guys, I just want to wrap up with a pretty interesting stat that came out. And Charles Howell III, actually the perfect like borderline premier golf league guy versus PGA Tour. He'd be like straddling the border because he's always that guy who's like the last into Augusta. Anyway, he made $39,100 for a T53 in Mexico. What's the big deal? You say, well, he crossed the $1 million mark, which we've talked about this. For the 20th straight year, that only Phil Mickelson has done it, 24 years and counting. Dan, Charles Howell, kind of like an underrated career, right?
It depends on how you how you measure careers, I suppose.
Right. Only three wins.
Three wins. Yeah. One of which came at Riviera, I think. So
yes.
He's got a prestigious
So to
one.
You, I mean, that's a major.
That's a huge one. That's the major. No, I think we're going to see a lot more people cross that threshold, by the way. I think as the years go on, you're going to see more guys who have made $1 million, because making $1 million on the PGA Tour now doesn't even guarantee that you keep your card.
Exactly.
I think 125 last year was like 1.4 or 1.5.
Yeah.
But yeah, speaks to consistency, speaks to the appeal. I think if you're ever in a debate and someone asks you, what sport would you want to play professionally? And Charles Howell is a really good piece of evidence for in favor of golf, to show that, you know, this guy who you probably haven't really heard of, the general public.
Right.
Made a million, you know, he's probably made 30-something million dollars in his career. And it's not just that he made it in chunks, it's that he just, it's this steady cash flow.
It's a really interesting concept with whether he's underrated, because if you looked at the hype around Charles Howell when he first came out on tour,
you'd come back,
he would say he's
underachieved.
Underachieved. Yep. However, your point is a really good one, that another model of a great career is consistency and longevity, and he's definitely achieved that. Like the NHL, they talk about first-round picks, like a first-round pick, and then he kind of petered out, but then he ends up playing 1,000 games in the NHL. That's a huge deal. Right. So like that's a sign of a great career. And so, you know, he's had a fantastic career on that level. Just, you know, never really sniffed contention in a major. I'm trying to think of a major.
I can't think of him ever being in the mix.
I think he's in a PGA once.
It's odd too that he wouldn't after all that. Yeah, it's an interesting career. Sam, I got to ask you quickly before we go, because Dan's not married yet and doesn't have a kid. The Masters theme bathroom. You saw the pictures.
Yes. Would I pull that off in my house?
Could you pull that off?
The answer is absolutely not.
Yeah, unless that's what I figured.
Well, the only thing is, my wife is always saying, like, I want my own bathroom.
Right.
I want to be away from you guys. Right. I have two boys. Like, she wants away. That would be the only way.
So she got her own.
Yeah, so it'd have to be additive. There's no way I can take one of our existing bathrooms and say, I'm making a completely Masters theme. Hope you're okay with that.
I agree. Same answer here. Amazing job by that guy, though. Well done. We enjoyed it. All right. Thanks a lot, guys. It was fun. Thanks again to Hal Sutton for joining us. Thanks to our producer, as always, Greg Gottfried. Thank you for listening. Please subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts already if you haven't done so. And check back next week to see who our guest is.